In 2021, Nobel Prize-winning economist Richard Thaler appeared here on Mountain Money to discuss his book, Nudge. Now, the core thesis of that book is that the biggest problems facing society could best be addressed by nudging individuals to make the right choices. Authors Nick Chatter and George Lowenstein have come to disagree, as set forth in their new book, It's On You. Here to help us understand why is Professor Nick Chatter. Good morning, Nick, and thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me on.
So, Nick, what motivated you and Professor Lowenstein to write the book, and how long did it take you to do the research?
Well, I mean, the research really took some decades in a way, because, I mean, George is one of the founders of the behavioral economics subfield, and along with Richard Thaler and Cass Sunstein and others, he was one of the people who started thinking about the very idea of nudging. He didn't encapsulate it quite so neatly in the term nudge, but at the same time as the original nudge paper was written, 2003, George and a group of colleagues wrote a companion paper called Regulation for Conservatives, with the same spirit, the idea that if you're worried about infringing people's liberties, you don't necessarily have to do that, and you can maintain a full range of choices, but you just have to give people essentially nudges, prods, shape the problem in a way that means that doing the right thing, the thing that's best for the person, the best for society, is just the easy, natural thing. So George has been playing this game for a long time, from really the beginning. I got interested probably 15 or 20 years ago, and in the UK I was on the advisory board of the Behavioral Insights team, which span out of the UK's Cabinet Office, which essentially works directly with the Prime Minister. And that was set up by David Cameron in 2010. And Cameron had just read Nudge. Nudge came out, the book came out in 2008. George and I then met in one of the meetings of the Behavioral Insights team, because we were both on this advisory board. And at that point, both still very enthusiastic that nudging could really make a difference to sort of substantial social problems. And we just became both sort of increasingly dispirited that we weren't making as much progress personally as we'd hoped. And also just for thinking that the field at large was struggling to really make an impact. So I think, you know, in a way, it's been very long in a gestation. The actual writing, it probably took us 6 or 7 years. It's been a long process. But very, very thankful to have it finally done.
So the book argues that nudges rarely work in the way that they're advertised or can even be harmful. When did you first become skeptical of the nudge agenda?
Well, I think it did creep up on me gradually. I think I was struck particularly when I was on a UK government committee called the Climate Change Committee, which is the committee that both sets and monitors UK carbon targets. So in the UK, we have a target to reduce emissions to zero by 2050, and that was set, or at least recommended by the Climate Change Committee, set by Parliament, of course. This committee is kind of a serious thing, and rather unexpectedly, they decided they wanted to have a behavioral scientist on the committee to help essentially with nudging people towards victory. And I was that lucky behavioral scientist, and it was a great experience, and people are tremendous, and it's a very impressive group. But I did find myself feeling that what I ought to be contributing would be useful solutions to help individuals that we could probably give to individuals to help them reduce their energy, change their diets, change their mode of transport, just generally change their lifestyles in a way that would be positive. And pretty much every turn I felt that was just not really feasible. And the things that really mattered were just big scale things. There are things like decarbonizing the grid, putting in lots of solar and wind, increasing battery storage, not that we've done too much of that, switching over to electric vehicles, really large scale things which require sort of conservative systemic changes or changing the way things are run, rather than working at the individual level. So I think the thing that George and I became, and I had the thing George and I were living sort of in parallel tracks, feeling the same things. We were feeling that we were sort of on the hook to try and deliver on what we promised ourselves. We thought, we people who study individuals, behavioral scientists fundamentally spend their time thinking about individual decision-making. We people who've studied individuals have got our chance to really help society. And in fact, cut through political deadlock and deal with the fact that there's no money available. So after the financial crisis, financial situation was very tight, as it has been pretty much ever since. It's up to us to really, really step up here and see if we can cut through all the political thickets and get right into into the sort of individual, the heart of each individual, and help us all lead better lives and create a better world. And it just seemed like we just were consistently failing to do that. And so on George's side, and then he had a bunch of studies trying to help people lose weight, help people exercise more. And his experience was the same as mine, that either your study didn't work at all, or it works a bit until the end of the study and everything goes back to normal. That's true with the exercise and diet types of case. It's not that nudges never work. Nudges can be powerful and they can be worth doing, absolutely. But it's they're just not an alternative to the big scale sort of systemic changes that are really required to tackle big problems.
And that kind of sets up the frameworks that you talk about. So can you explain the difference between what you guys label as S-frame and I-frame policies?
Yes. So I think this is a key insight. It's not a very profound insight. I mean, it's sort of something we should have realized all along. But when we thought of it, we thought, oh, yes, that makes sense. So that helps us understand where we've been going wrong. So the idea is that there are these two basic ways you can think about social problems, and that we as academics, but just everyday folks and policymakers, that we all have these two modes in mind. And one mode is to think that the problem is fundamentally working at the individual level. So people are doing the wrong things. They're not eating the right things. They're gambling too much. They're drinking too much. They're burning too much carbon. They're just leading the wrong kind of lifestyle. And what we need to do is to help people fix their lifestyles, both for their own good and potentially in the case of things like climate change or reducing pollution, for the common good as well. That's one perspective. And the other perspective is this system-level change. It's a system-level perspective where you say, well, we're all part of these gigantically complicated markets with complicated regulation and governments that impose the rules and subsidize some things and tax other things. So all of that massively complicated set of interlocking systems, that's where the real action is. And the thing is that psychologically, it's very hard. Two things that are worth noting. One is that it's very hard for us to think about things from two frames, in two frames at once. We see things either as individual problems or as societal systemic problems, but we can't really see that both ways. So once we start to think people aren't saving enough for retirement, we're immediately thinking, oh, it's that those people need to sort themselves out, maybe, because these individuals are making a mistake, they're not putting enough money aside, we need to help them do better. And at that point, we've immediately forgotten, oh, but hang on, how did the pension system used to work? Once upon a time, we didn't really have this problem. And of course, there are other issues, like people are living longer. That's another systemic problem. But if as soon as you think people are saving too little, you're into the I frame, and you've forgotten about the S frame. And I think that's, that if you're coming from the perspective we were, which is sort of behavioral science, psychology, behavioral economics, then you're automatically locked into that I-frame way of seeing things. And the other psychological insight, I think, is that the I-frame is really natural for us as human beings, for all of us, because we spend our lives interacting at the micro level with other people. We spend our lives in social interactions with small numbers of individuals. And so thinking about some people make a better job of things than others. Some people are reliable, some are not so reliable. Some get addicted to things, some don't. Some pull themselves together, some fail to. It's very natural to think it's all about the differences between individuals, because that's the stuff of everyday social interaction. But what we're not very good at perceiving, not surprisingly, is the big scale stuff, because that's kind of fixed background that is really complicated. So I think there's both a problem that the I frame and the S frame are kind of intention. That of course you might reasonably say, well, hang on, don't you need both of these at some level? Yes, of course you do. But the trouble is, if you think about one too much, it blocks the other one. And the second problem is that we tend to be, as humans, automatically locked into thinking in an I frame way, because that's with creatures of local social behavior.
Yeah, so that's us. We are the I. They are the S. So for listeners who haven't read the book, so let's say we're talking about climate change, and I get stuck on, in my I frame of recycling and, not burning firewood in my fireplace and taking shorter showers. I'm missing the whole S. I'm not even getting involved in what the systemic issue is.
Yes, and the worrying thing is that there is at least some evidence, and it certainly can happen that thinking about the I frame can actually diminish your support for things like carbon taxes. So the big stuff we need, things like massive amounts of wind and solar and some kind of cap and trade system globally or a carbon tax or whatever, the various ways of doing it, but these massive things that are required, it's very easy to think, well, this kind of big swinging, heavy-handed action isn't really so crucial because, you know, here I am not burning my firewood, and here I am recycling my yogurt pots. And if everyone else would just pull themselves together and do the same thing, then you wouldn't need all this big stuff. So I think, unfortunately, that's one of the things that really worried us. And this also leads to the fear that, of course, if you're trying to slow people down in pushing for serious regulation and government action, then a really good strategy is to try to encourage them to think at the individualistic level. So that's a tactic one might suspect that big corporations might even be using.
Yeah, and you do talk about that. I mean, and it's really pretty fascinating. So let's flesh that out a little bit. How and why have corporate interests pushed the framing of problems like climate change onto individuals?
Yeah, I think the strategy is a very clever one, one can think of it as sort of deeply cynical. But I think it's sort of inevitable. It's not that there's something sort of inherently sort of Machiavellian about corporations or the people in them any more than any other human beings. It's just it's kind of what you'd expect when you think about it. So the strategy is that if you want to distract attention away from the need, for, essentially in the case of the fossil fuel industry, to create an environment which will just run that industry into the ground. I mean, there's just no escaping it. I mean, unless there's some extraordinary amount of CO2 capture, which is, no one's really putting money into that. On a grand scale, it's just inevitable that the fossil fuel industries are, in the long term, just going to have to basically shut down, apart from a pretty marginal capacity compared to where they are now. Now that's pretty nightmarish if you're a fossil fuel industry. So what your best strategy is to try to discourage people from pushing, supporting the kinds of moves that would lead to that, and instead to focus their minds on the iframes. And so BP, one of the world's major oil companies, had a campaign way back in the 2000s, quite a high profile, indeed award winning campaign called Beyond Petroleum, where they both tried to give the impression they were themselves moving beyond petroleum and sort of getting terribly interested in renewables, which they really weren't in any serious way, but also to try to help people think from an iframe point of view about the problem. So they were the people who first propagated the individual carbon footprint. So the idea that each of us should be tracking our own carbon footprint. They had a carbon footprint calculator that I think some hundreds of thousands of people used in all innocence, really, to find out their carbon footprint. They had posters saying things like, perhaps it's time to go on a no-carbon diet. Now, it's a brilliant strategy because it both makes all of us think, oh, it's an individual problem. And of course, if you see if you see someone else who's not being quite as careful about the climate as you are, then you can think, there's a problem.
That's the problem.
there they are. Look, there's that person going past a large SUV. That's the problem right there. Rather than thinking, well, hang on, the fact that we have these, this giant amount of oil exploration and exploitation going on, we have to be changing the system to shut that down in the long term. But the other thing, of course, that's very clever is that it also positions them as kind of helpful as trying to solve the problem. Of course, if they really thought it was going to work, they wouldn't be trying so hard, right? They're trying to get us to think about the iframe because they sort of know that if we try and reduce our fossil fuel consumption just by sort of force of will and being a bit more careful, will have a marginal effect. So that business model is totally safe.
Now, do these corporations hire individuals with your specialty, let's say, to kind of get more people to think I-frame instead of S-frame?
I think it's actually very interesting. I think the people inside PR agencies sort of seem to have intuited this stuff long ago. It's really quite shocking. It's a bit disturbing for people who are kind of special academics. You'd like to think, well, we ought to be at the frontiers here. But I think the truth is that the professionals inside these PR agencies and advertising agencies have actually kind of got there before we have. We kind of trundled in later and thought, oh, that's what they're doing. So I think that's partly true. I think it's also partly true that the in many domains, particularly, for example, with thinking about food industry. The food industry has spent quite a lot of money trying to encourage research, which is looking at, for example, the power of exercise to reduce weight. So that's a very good thing to be focusing on if you're a part of the food industry, which is selling people very, very energy-dense food, because, of course, you don't want them to eat less energy-dense food and drinks. You want them to find some other solution and to see exercise as that solution. So, yeah, it's not that necessarily that research is all bogus research, but they've certainly worked hard to get the scientific parts of the scientific community to start thinking about iframe solutions, even if those iframe solutions aren't really going to touch the problem very seriously.
I wanted to ask about I was going to ask you about corporate interests pushing individual responsibility and obesity, but I think we've touched on that. But I want to move on to how the S-frame structure explains the growth of inequality since 1980. How does that sort of apply to this big picture?
Yeah, I think inequality is such an interesting case because it's so easy to think that the massive divergence of life outcomes between people, which of course is in just purely financial terms, but in many other ways is gigantic. It's very easy to think, well, that's clearly about individuals, isn't it? I mean, there are some individuals who get to Harvard or Stanford, and they work hard and they found a business and it goes really well and they get very rich, and those people are probably pretty exceptional individuals on the whole. And there's, you know, most of us don't do that, and some of us are really struggling. And it's, you know, the differences between people. This is iframe thinking, are really what's driving things. And that's, you know, if we wanted to improve the situation, if we're worried about inequality, and not everybody is, some people might say, well, the problem's poverty, not inequality. That's not an illegitimate perspective. But if we're not worried about, if we're worried about inequality, we might think, well, what we need to do is we need to, you know, provide sort of bursaries and help for the people who are struggling. But then, of course, if you think, well, hang on, though, what's happened to inequality over the last 40 years? And what's happened is it's just grown tremendously, or 50 years, I guess. So really things started to change pretty dramatically in particular countries, and the US and UK being the most notable, quite fast around the late 1970s, early 1980s. And what was going on there was a big deliberate policy change. And it was a liberalization of the economy. It was a very active reduction in unionization, and also a big changes to the taxation system, which has continued, especially in the US, of just reducing the degree of tax on corporations, but also on highly paid individuals. So there's just been a really, really concentrated and concerted change. And that's not happened everywhere in the world. So there are many other countries, if you looked at, say, Germany or Japan, which are in many ways quite comparable countries, but they haven't had, you know, the same level of increase in inequality. So if you went back to the very, you know, high growth, prosperous periods in US economic history, sort of 50s and 60s, inequality was much less than it is now. And things seemed to be going pretty well, actually. I mean, it wasn't that, you know, innovation was being stifled, growth was sort of moribund, quite the opposite. And similarly, you can look back in history and you can look across at different nations and the story looks different. It looks different for systemic reasons. Now, I think we don't want to particularly put a strong sort of moral slant on this, but we just want to stress to people that the real driver, the things that really drive the level of inequality are political choices. They're not sort of either inevitable and they're not really about individual people. Of course, exactly which people become billionaires, that's not complete chance. There's individual factors in there. But the fact that, for example, that a very large amount of the economic growth that's occurred over the last decade or two, in the US especially, has been largely taken by a very small number of people, sort of in the top sort of 0.1% or so, taking a great good chunk of it. That is a sort of a result of systemic choices.
Some listeners might say, you know, but small individual actions still matter, don't they? How do you draw the line between meaningful personal responsibility and the kind of blame shifting that you're criticizing?
It is a difficult dividing line, because I think we don't want to feel as individuals, and I think it's not right to feel that what we do doesn't matter at all. I mean, there are 8.3 billion of us. None of us matter. I mean, at least almost all of us don't matter that much in terms of our power over the world. I mean, most of us just don't have much influence. And of course, you know, if there are individual consuming lives, you know, what we buy and which holidays we go on, so these are pretty marginal. But we do, and everything we do is marginal because we're small and the world is big. But I think what we should do is remind ourselves that the things that really change the world and have done so historically are campaigns for structural systemic change. So if you think about things like widening the franchise, so in the UK, once upon a time we didn't have a democracy of any kind. Then we had a king who was fairly powerless, and there was a parliament, but the parliament was sort of very, very corrupt, and only a very small number of people had to vote. And then just gradually, there's just widening and widening and widening of franchise at every stage, fought tooth and nail. So it wasn't easy. And then finally, you get votes for women and votes for people without property. And then obviously, you have other massive changes like the abolition of slavery and the civil rights movement. And all of these things arise because of bottom-up pressure and organized campaigning, and they're changing the rules of the game in really fundamental ways, and those really matter. And when looking back, we think, well, thank goodness, how on earth did we tolerate those previous rules so long? But that's the real drivers for change, I think, are sort of political action. And in times when politics is fractured and broken, feels very broken, one can feel despairing at that point and think, well, it's never going to happen. But I think historically there have been, equally polarized and difficult periods, and change can nonetheless be driven through in the end. So I think we shouldn't do those individual good things. Try and buy the responsibly sourced fish and so on. I think that's all good, but we should also not forget that the real action is pushing for political, essentially systemic change.
I want to digress just for a minute. Are there examples in which S-frame and I-frame policies are actually symbiotic? They actually work together?
Yeah, I think there are. And in fact, probably there are quite a lot. The psychology works against us here, because as I said, once we start to think about the problem individualistically, we tend to lose interest or just lose focus on the system. But there totally are. And I know one that Cass Sunstein is very keen on pointing out to George and I. And Cass with Richard Thaler is the co-author of Nudge, and a wonderful, wonderful scholar. I mean, Richard Thaler is clearly Nobel Prize winning and economist. These are very, very brilliant people, and Cass is one of the US's leading legal scholars. But Cass is always pointing out to us that smoking, actually, is a really interesting example where the legislation and the individualistic framing seem to have worked really well. And I think one reason that works, what has been true, is that it seems to have been possible for the legislation to be actually pushed and accepted quite happily, even by smokers. Certainly in the UK, there's been quite a lot of work, and I imagine it's the same in the US, a lot of work, which is rather surprisingly shown that, for example, when you stop cigarette smoking in pubs, you might imagine that smokers would think this was terrible and a huge infringement of liberties. But actually, once it happened, most smokers thought, "Oh, thank goodness for that. That's great." And I mean, it's just like, sitting here in a fog of smoke was horrible. And in fact, and I don't really want to be encouraged to smoke. And there are clearly exceptions, but the general sense that this is kind of something we're all as a society happy with, including the people who are struggling, as many people are in case of smoking, struggling to quit. So I think there are cases where there doesn't have to be a diametric opposition between the I frame and the S frame, and they can work together. And I think that's the best thing. And indeed, I think one study that George did some years ago, where he initially discovered that the telling people about the how they could reduce their own carbon footprint reduced their enthusiasm for large scale climate action, but he also found that if you pointed out to people that was quite a quite a small effect, the individual could only have a small effect, then that undercutting of the systemic didn't sort of went away. So I think it's a matter of realizing I can do my bit, but there's the big things need to be done too.
So kind of a different twist here. If nudges and personal responsibility campaigns are not the answer, what does a better policy playbook look like to you?
Well, I think that there are sort of a couple of things. I mean, one of the key challenges, which where I think in theory people like George and I, behavioral scientists, should be able to say something useful, we'll see how far that's true, is thinking, how do we design and frame policies in a way that actually makes them attractive to everyday folks, including ourselves? So, for example, carbon taxes are often a disastrous start by being taxes. I mean, who likes a tax? So it clearly, we need to think about essentially, you know, redistributing money, right? There's, if you think that the government is trying to raise extra revenue and they're going to do it by taxing some of your activities, no one's going to be supporting that. But if we think, no, we're not trying to raise revenue, we're simply moving money around, which is true of some of the policies, for example, in some states in Canada, then that's a different story. And then you can think, oh, okay, so yeah, I might actually gain from this. If I'm pretty careful on my, if I tread lightly upon the world, maybe I'll be better off, and you sort of will be. So I think thinking about the way you frame your policy is really crucial. And I think the other issue is thinking about how to build coalitions of support. And here, I think often thinking about what you're actually pushing for in a very thoughtful way is crucial. So for example, congestion charges, I think are often extremely unpopular when they come in. Cities that have had them generally tend to find that the people either feel neutral about them or actually quite like them because they do work in reducing congestion. But again, congestion charge is another charge. It sounds like a bad thing. Who wants to be charged to do something you've previously doing for free? But there, I think one strategy is to think about introducing them for time-limited periods, saying we're going to do this for, you know, a few months, and then we're going to vote on it, or we're going to have some process. And yeah, if it doesn't reduce congestion, we're just going to give up. And that's probably a good strategy, just because trying stuff out experimentally is something we should be doing anyway, rather than just launching in. But also, I think it makes it much easier to sell for all of us. We're all happier to think, well, okay, I don't think this is going to work. If it doesn't work, then, you know, but it's going to be binned. Okay, well, let's give it a try, rather than trying something, you know, which is kind of all or nothing. This congestion charge will be with you for eternity. So I think, yeah, these are just examples, but I think the key really is thinking, how do we both design policies and think about how to build support for those policies in a psychologically thoughtful way? And of course, it's this, you know, political strategists and campaigners are doing this intuitively, often very well already. Hopefully there's some sort of something that the psychologists and behavioral economists can add to that process. That's what we're going to be trying to do anyway.
So now you and George are both influential in the behavioral economics world. How uncomfortable was it to turn a critical lens on your own field?
It was uncomfortable. It was. And I think we were very cheered at the same time. So we're halfway through the paper, writing the book, we kind of felt, we're hopelessly stuck. It's so complicated. We don't know what the key point is. So we thought we'll try and write a short piece, like an academic paper. And we'll try and encapsulate some of the core ideas and just put that out. And then maybe we'll clear up our thinking and be able to finish the book, which is kind of what happened. When we put that paper out, we stuck it on the, as one does these days, stuck it on the web, expecting nothing really to happen. And weirdly, it suddenly started to pick up lots of interest, and people were talking about it, sometimes positively, sometimes negatively. But there was a sort of storm. Well, storm is probably exaggeration, but as much as a storm as you would ever get in the academic, our part of the academic world anyway, there was a lot of interest. But a lot of the response was from people saying, oh, you're so right. No, I've kind of thought this myself, and I'd never quite put it in that way, but that's sort of how I feel. For people inside the behavioral science movement. So I think that was very heartening, that there are obviously people saying, you know, this is really damaging what we've been trying to do all these years, and it's a backward step. But equally, there were quite a lot of people saying, oh, thank goodness someone's come out and said it. So I think, you know, it was a mixed experience.
Yeah.
Going forward, what do you hope the book's effect will be on both individuals and policymakers?
Well, I think at the individual level, this is going back to the previous comment, really, I think it would be, I would like people to read the book and think more about the systems that shape all the social problems we have, and thinking about the way we need to change those systems. And beyond all, underneath all of the specifics, of course, are the forces that are shaping the rules of the game itself. I mean, you know, if you have a great deal of campaign money coming from particular industries, fossil fuels, big tech, crypto, not surprisingly, the rules of the game are going to be moving in a very favorable direction for fossil fuels, big tech, and crypto. So yeah, this, we kind of all know this, but I think just really realizing how powerful that is, and how, because we are shaped by those systemic rules, that this is something we need to worry a lot about. So I think at the individual level, being sensitivity to the S frame, and realizing that this is where, you know, this is really the chance of shaping, creating a better society is all about getting those rules right. That's one thing. And at the level of policymakers, I think trying to restore a sense of ambition at the S-frame level. So rather than having people think, well, the rules are kind of fixed and we as policymakers, we can only tinker, trying to restore a sense that, no, actually, historically, we've made massive changes. Possibly some of them in the wrong direction, but it's like, we go back to the point about inequality. We had a much less unequal society. We made some big changes. We've got a more unequal society. But not every country has that, and those rules could be changed back again. Just having a sense that those levers are still there and they can be reshaped.
The book is It's On You. We spent a delightful time chatting with Nick Chatter, the author. Thanks so much for spending time with us.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
And also thank you for turning the critical eye on yourself and your field. I mean, I thought this book was fascinating.
All right, we'll be right back after this.